Welcome to Thursday, the 8th of June. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. What matters more, how much money you have or how you feel about how much money you have? We're going to get at that in just a few minutes. But first, a new development for the city of Seattle and the sports fans all around it, and anyone trying to drive around at game time. Yesterday, Seattle's mayor chose an investor group to renovate Key Arena. Mayor Ed Murray said he wants NHL hockey and NBA basketball to be there in Seattle Center. But wait, there is another plan for a new sports stadium. An investment group has land in the Soto neighborhood. They want to bring hockey and basketball there. Has the city now abandoned the Soto idea? My next guest says no. Wally Walker is general manager of Seattle's old NBA team, the Sonics. He's one of those investors pushing for the Soto Arena. Welcome, Wally.
Hey, Bill.
This is the sound of Seattle Mayor Ed Murray talking up Key Arena and Seattle Center as the ideal spot for pro sports.
Located at the intersection of our booming South Lake Union Tech Hub, a future light rail station, and two of the city's densest neighborhoods, downtown, uptown, as well as other neighborhoods such as Queen Anne, Seattle Center is posed to be a global cultural district. And that's why we're here this afternoon, because we have a community asset. It's called an arena, and it deserves bold investments.
Wally, doesn't that sound like Ed Murray's made up his mind?
Oh, he has, but the city council makes the decision on what happens, and he's made a recommendation about who he's going to negotiate with going forward. The terms yet to be determined, and that's critical, because all we've seen are kind of generalities about what it means for the city, their cost, their liability, and more specifically, what happens with the taxpayers and what they're on the hook for.
Yeah, let's talk about the taxpayers. Mayor Murray said he thinks that the best deal is the Key Arena deal, but he also said that the taxpayers are on the hook currently for this asset in Seattle Center, Key Arena.
We own this property. This property is in desperate need of renovation. If it were to exist even on, you know, without major teams, we'd have to do something with it. If there's an arena built somewhere else, we have a huge liability on our hands, a place that could easily go dark and have a negative impact on the neighborhood.
So, Wally Walker, what do you want to say to the taxpayers of Seattle?
Well, there'd be so much tax revenue for the city, county, state, but mostly the city generated from the Soto Arena that it would pay for what they want to do with Key Arena and a lot of other things. Let me give you one example. Privately financed Soto Arena pays property tax, over which half goes to Washington State Schools, which over the course of a 30-plus year lease would generate over $100 million for Washington State Schools. That would be zero from Key Arena. But beyond that, there are a lot of other tax revenue sources coming from Soto that wouldn't be generated for the public and the general coffers from a Seattle Center renovation.
So the head of the Key Arena investor group, Tim Leiwecki, said in his bid, quote, there's zero cost to the city, none, not a penny. But you're saying it's not just about risk, that the Soto Arena idea, that would bring in more money for the city.
Well, two things. One, in their proposal, there are things like called tax reinvestment, tax sharing, emissions tax. The Goldman Sachs letter that they showed finally on Monday night said tax rebates. Well, where are those coming from? They're coming from either the owner, the ticket buyer in terms of emissions tax, or from the public. When you're talking about reinvesting it, that needs to be fleshed out. The other part of it is there's a huge opportunity cost relative to Soto, because Soto is going to generate tens of millions for the city every year in tax revenue.
Why is, let's stepping away from the financing plans for a moment, why, you heard Ed Murray talking about what a jewel of a location Key Arena and Seattle Center are. Why is Soto a better spot for Sonics and hockey?
Transportation and parking, if you want to boil it down in as simple terms as possible. You have quotes from people like Ron Sims in 2012 saying that the Soto Stadium District had the best transportation infrastructure of any stadium district in the country. I agree with him. I haven't seen all of them, but I've seen a lot of them. And it's multimodal, and it's just the best there is. So, Seattle Center, I've spent a lot of time there. I was a tenant there running the Sonics for 11 years. I played there for a number of years. It has some charm, but the neighborhood has changed. The parking supply has gone away. The traffic has gotten worse, not better. And if anyone thinks that trend is going to change, I'd like to hear the reasons why.
One more quick piece of audio. This is Mayor Murray when he's asked whether the SoDo plan is dead, and he says, well...
So the SoDo plan is still technically alive?
Technically alive. Is that like the Cleveland Cavaliers are technically still alive in the NBA Finals?
Well, again, the city council is going to make this decision. The mayor has made his recommendation about a negotiation. We haven't seen a final deal. We welcome a comparison. Whatever final deal they arrive, and hopefully there's independent analysis. I'm told by city council members there will be a lot of time spent on the independent analysis that was already spent on the SoDo project some 5 years ago. And there should be. There needs to be. It's a big investment for somebody, and it could be a big liability for Seattle City and state taxpayers. Take a close look at it. Compare the two. Make your decision. We accept that.
Wally Walker, finally, I take it you have love for the Sonics. You played. You were a general manager of the Sonics. The group that's leading the Key Arena bid, your rival, says, hey, investors, SoDo investors, join us. If the city council is not into your SoDo location, Wally, would you switch teams and help bring the Sonics back to Key Arena?
Well, that would be a decision for the majority owner of an NBA team, not the third-party operator being OBG. And I also think that if that's really a good-faith offer, wouldn't you pick up the phone and ask that before you get into a public press conference? So I don't know what that was about.
He hasn't called you up? He hasn't called Chris Hansen?
I haven't gotten that call, no.
No? Well, I'm asking you now.
What we want and what we've always wanted is a solution that would attract both the NBA and NHL. We'd be happy if it works out at a Key Arena, whatever it's going to be called in the future. We'd still own the SoDo real estate, and we'd just go ahead. We have some real concerns that need to be pointed out as it relates to the ability to attract an NBA and NHL teams, given the structure and the cost that is currently proposed.
Wally Walker, part of Chris Hansen's investment group, looking to bring a new arena, not to Seattle Center, but to the SoDo neighborhood, and he's a former NBA player and GM at the Sonics. And Wally Walker, we'll watch it together and see if you can, it sounds like you're saying, yeah, we're not convincing Ed Murray, but you and your group will try to convince Seattle City Council otherwise, and we'll hope you join us again. Thank you.
Well, and the taxpayers need to pay close attention, too, for, you know, both the cost to them, the potential liability, and what they're giving up relative to the proposals. And again, we don't know the final one for the Seattle Center, and we'll all take a look and hope a good decision gets made.
Yeah, we'll be comparing the competing financing packages on KUOW, and hope you'll be part of it, Wally Walker.
Yeah, good.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'd love to.
Ed Murray, thanks, Wally. Again, Ed Murray announcing yesterday he supports the proposal to renovate Key Arena for both an NBA and NHL team, and the mayor said he hopes to have approval for the deal from the city council by the end of the year. You can see there's a lot of convincing and elaborating to come. You'll hear about it here on KUOW Seattle. It's KUOW's The Record on Twitter, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Greater Seattle is an unequal place. There are people who are working full-time who can't afford even a small apartment in the city of Seattle. Now, you might say to that, big deal. You can't afford to live exactly where you want to live. If you have food and clothing and shelter and probably a smartphone, maybe a big-screen TV, well, you have enough. Well, our next guest says it's not that simple, because even if you're not poor, it matters that you feel poor. Psychologist Keith Payne has written the new book, The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die. Keith Payne, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So inequality is not poverty. Poverty is crushing. It's desperate. It's dangerous. Why is inequality dangerous?
When we think about inequality, so often we reduce it to the question of poverty, but it's a different issue. What inequality does is makes everybody feel like they have less, even if they don't. So the average middle-class person in a society that's very unequal will tend to feel as if they're poorer than if they're they have the same amount of money living in a more equal place. So because of that subjective perception of whether you're doing well off, whether you are badly off, that subjective perception connects inequality in the distribution of incomes to individual levels of perceived poverty.
Yeah, you have written that we don't look down the social ladder, we look up. How does that work?
Right. So people socially compare all the time. In other words, we look to the people around us to figure out if we're tall enough, if we're good looking enough, if we've got enough money. And we tend to be selective in who we compare to. So when it comes to money, we tend to ignore those who have less than us, and we tend to pay attention to those who have more than us. You'll notice that there are no reality shows about middle class, average, ordinary Americans. What we want to watch, whether it's on TV or in tabloids or in our daily lives, is the people who have more than us.
But why is that? Why wouldn't we rather focus on people who have less, and then maybe we feel better about ourselves?
Right. Logically, you would think that was true. Both comparing upward and comparing downward have costs and benefits. Comparing to those who have less than us makes us feel better, but it's also demotivating. It makes us feel like, well, that's good enough. I can relax now. Comparing upward, on the other hand, makes us feel terrible, but it's also motivating. And it can motivate us to work harder, but it can also motivate us to make risky decisions and make bad decisions in the effort to catch up to those who have more than us.
Man, that makes us sound so ambitious. I still don't really understand, why wouldn't I rather look at somebody who makes me feel like I want to relax than I want to work harder?
Right. And in fact, that's one of the things that I recommend in the book as one way to manage these social comparisons, is that, you know, we have the capability to compare upward or compare downward. And I think we need to do a little bit more comparing downward, because what that does is puts our own lives in a bit of perspective that, hey, maybe we're not doing so bad. But I think in ordinary life, what we tend to do, we default over and over again to these upward social comparisons.
Okay. And then this is key to your argument in your book. What do we do with that perception as communities? What do we do with this? You say it's a fact that we look down the social, not down, but up the social ladder. And then what do we do with that?
Are you saying what should we do, or
no, what do we actually do? You document the problems that come when people feel unequal.
Right. So those that perception that others around us have more than we do ends up making us feel subjectively poorer. And the interesting thing psychologically is that when people feel like they're poor, they in many ways act like they're poor. In other words, all of the problems that we tend to associate with poverty, like crime, like behavioral problems, like dropping out of school or performing poorly in educational contexts. If you're in a wealthy, developed nation like America, those are actually better predicted by inequality than by poverty. Because once people have those basic necessities that you outlined at the beginning, what matters for their behavior is often how much they feel like they have.
Yeah, even a lower life expectancy, you claim.
Even a lower life expectancy. If you look across wealthy developed nations, like comparing the states of Europe and Asia and America, those economies that are economically advanced, those countries that have more inequality tend to have shorter life expectancies. And that's even if you adjust for the average wealth in those societies. So we see longer life expectancies in countries that have poorer average incomes, like Italy or Ireland, than in America, which is by far the wealthiest, but also the most unequal of those countries.
We're talking with psychologist Keith Payne, author of The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die. And I was interested to hear you recommend that we do more looking down the social ladder rather than up, because there is a couple solutions, right? One would be reduce inequality, tax the rich, give more to the poor. But another would be, well, change your thinking. Focus on what you have, not on what someone else has. What's the best solution in your mind?
I think we need to pursue both of those solutions at the same time, because they work on different problems and in different ways. I think it's basically human nature to compare to other people. And there's lots of evidence that we look to those who have more as a pretty common human trait. So if you look at a population level, most people are going to keep comparing themselves. And because of that basic fact of human nature, I think the larger solution, the larger longer term, big picture solution is to reduce levels of actual income inequality. But in the short term, that's probably not going to happen tomorrow. So at the individual level, given that we are in the world that we're in, I think individuals can learn something from the psychological studies and be more strategic and smarter about the ways that we engage in social comparisons.
In fact, you propose another solution. Move to a if I understand you right, you recommend moving to some place where everybody has about the same amount of money. Why is that?
Right. So I'm not recommending that everybody pick up and move from wherever they are to some new place that has more equality. But I do point out that when we are looking to move, we often check out the neighborhoods that we're thinking about moving to. And we say, well, how good are the schools and how nice are the houses and how nice are the parks and things like that in the area. And these are all ways of asking, is this a well-off community or an impoverished community? And most people try to get into the nicest neighborhood or community they can, and that makes perfect sense. But what we don't tend to do is say, well, what level of inequality is in this community? And what the data shows is that the level of inequality in a community is just as predictive of good or bad outcomes for your kids as the level of poverty or wealth in that community. So one thing that we're not doing that we should probably pay more attention to is looking at the level of inequality in the communities that we're considering moving to.
So you're not just saying, I want to live in a community where I have about the average amount of money that everybody does. You're going beyond that and saying, I want to live in a community where everybody is more or less equal because problems crop up in communities where there are disparities?
That's right. I mean, you don't want to live in a place that has desperate poverty right next to you probably, because we know that that comes along with a lot of social problems. But what we don't often realize is that you also probably don't want to live in a place where there's some poverty right up against extravagant wealth, because those kinds of places have lots of crime and social problems as well.
Well, I ask you because this sounds like kind of the opposite of what Seattle is trying to do, because we're talking about allowing, we're pretty much a single family, we have a lot of single family neighborhoods in this city comparatively, and we're talking about allowing more affordable apartments and triplexes and duplexes in single family neighborhoods that have these soaring land values. So this might not be poverty next to extreme glamorous wealth, but we are talking about making our neighborhoods more economically diverse. Are you saying that's a tricky road?
Well, it depends on the level of analysis you're looking at. So if you look at the level of the country or the level of a state or even the level of counties, the places with greater inequality after you control for the average level of income tend to have more problems. But it doesn't necessarily translate down to the level of an individual apartment building. It's not just that, if there's one apartment that has a regular middle class person living in it, and there's also a fancy penthouse in that same building, that's necessarily going to cause problems. It's more at a larger social level that you see the problems of inequality outweighing the problems of individual wealth or poverty.
What did you think when the housing secretary, Ben Carson, said that poverty is partly a state of mind?
I thought that was an interesting statement. I think there's a sense in which he's onto something, because poverty does have strong connections to people's psychology and the way that they perceive the world. But I think he got cause and effect exactly backwards. I think the point he was trying to make is that some people overcome no matter what obstacles, and they will be successful even if they are faced with poverty or other kinds of challenges. And I would point to data that shows that the environment in which you grow up has a huge impact on the kind of character that you develop. So, with things like crime, problems like high school dropouts, and so on and so forth, we can predict how a kid's going to turn out before they are even born if we just know what zip code they're about to be born into. The effect of whether you're born into wealth or poverty creates massive effects on the type of thinking you're likely to develop. And that's exactly backwards from what Ben Carson, I think, was trying to say.
Yeah, I want to wrap this up with highlighting that idea. It seems like you have landed in a philosophical argument that we're having in America, and Seattle for sure, a time of income inequality, is we should redistribute the wealth or you need to focus on what you have. And, you know, it's the problems are in your own habits of mind. And it seems like you're saying yes and.
Well, I think you have a philosophical aspect to it in terms of what we ought to do about it and how you see the world and what political choices we make. But at bottom, I don't think the effect of inequality on people's life outcomes is really a philosophical problem. It's not subjective. We have lots and lots of good, strong data showing that places with higher income inequality systematically produce worse outcomes for people. And it's an empirical question.
Right. I take your point. Not just a matter of opinion. That's what your book is sort of all about. Like, guess what? Inequality has real life, measurable, predictable effects.
There's nothing more sort of real and objective than mortality rates, right? And levels of income inequality at the both national level and state level predict how long people live.
Psychologist Keith Payne, in the new book of his, is The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die. Surely something we think about in the Seattle area, especially these days in our booming economy. And Keith Payne, thanks for talking with us about it on KUOW.
Good to be with you.
I'd be happy to hear what you think about all this. We're tweeting at KUOW. You can write us an email, record@kuow.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. You know, being a teenager in America is hard enough. Imagine being a teenager growing up with two very different cultures and only wanting one of them. From KUOW's reporting team, Radioactive, here's Soraya Marashi.
On the first day of eighth grade, a boy walked up to me and asked if I had a bomb in my backpack. The whole class erupted into laughter. My cheeks turned bright red and I sank into my seat. People had stereotyped me before, but this was the first time I felt it, and it felt like a bomb had been dropped onto my lap. I began to feel ashamed all the time. I felt it every morning when the teacher took attendance and called out my exotic-sounding name, Soraya Marashi. In my history classes, when I felt the stares of my classmates during the annual 9/11 lesson, and when I looked into the eyes of my own mother.
I felt guilty when you would come home and I didn't see happiness or peace. I thought maybe if I had given you, like, I don't know, a more American middle name, then you could have used that. Was I selfish because I was, like, loyal to my culture? You know, you start to doubt yourself when your kid is unhappy when they come home. And I thought maybe if we had moved back home, it would have been better.
Iran is the home my mom is talking about. My grandparents immigrated to America from Iran, with my mother and her siblings in tow, to escape the Iraq War. They both lived with us for much of my childhood, and this allowed our Iranian traditions to continue to thrive. But that doesn't mean I was raised in a particularly religious household. We didn't pray five times a day, we didn't cut pork out of our diet, and we didn't wear the hijab. But my little brother and I kissed the Quran before we left for school each morning. We burned incense to block out the evil eye. And we all spoke Farsi in the house every day. Assalam alaikum, peace be upon you. Mashallah, God has willed. Khuda hafiz, God be with you.
Most people believe that in America, there are Muslims who want to live here and live under our Constitution, but too much, we find a growing number of them that believe Sharia should supersede the U.S. Constitution, and one there admit, look, he's in other countries.
The glimpses of Islam I experienced as a kid didn't necessarily match up with the portrayals of Islam I saw on the news. Words like jihad and Sharia law echoed in my head. Images of terrorist organizations claiming to follow Islam, holding assault rifles, and proudly taking responsibility for attacks on innocent civilians. I stopped learning Farsi. I stopped kissing the Quran. At family gatherings, I stayed up in my room. When somebody asked me about my culture, I would say, I am Muslim. But I would make sure they knew that I was non-practicing. Not because I cared if they knew about my upbringing, but because I didn't want to be associated with Islam. My mother told me that my diversity and uniqueness made me beautiful, but I didn't want to be diverse. I wanted to be normal. I didn't want my name. I didn't want my olive skin, my big nose, my dark hair. I wanted so desperately to look like the blonde-haired and blue-eyed girls I was surrounded with every day. But even as I wrestled with the shame I felt about my culture, there was one memory that shame just couldn't seem to touch. It began as an accident, but I became more and more intrigued with every encounter. My grandmother, my Bibi John, could never hear the sound of my little bare feet against the hard wooden floor as I tiptoed in to observe. I would wait quietly in the dark corner, wide-eyed and perplexed at the most beautiful white hijab upon her head. I listened to her murmur prayers from the Quran and bow her head to the floor 8 consecutive times, all in reverence to her Allah.
They say how you dream indicates your thought process. And so Bibi John always dreamt, when she would tell me her dreams, of her small town, and she would speak Farsi in her dreams. She is a follower of all the things that she grew up with, believing in, and being a mother first, she sacrificed a lot. But I, now that I am westernized in my beliefs, I never thought it was a flaw, her belief system and her traditions. That's who she is. If you take those away from her, it's someone different, right? It's part of who she is.
I didn't realize the beauty of being different. I let my uniqueness isolate me from my peers, rather than let it bring us together. And right around the same time, I began to love my culture again. Something else happened. In high school, most of my friends were white and knew nothing about Middle Eastern culture. But they began to ask me if they could try Persian food. They wanted to learn how we danced at weddings. They wanted to listen to my mother speak to her relatives on the phone.
Hello, babujan, salam aleikum.
My teachers began keeping me after class to ask me questions about myself and my culture, how I grew up. My confidence grew and grew. I learned how to block out the occasional ignorant comment. After all, I knew my culture better than anyone. I lived it every day. It was rooted in my identity. And I knew what it felt like to be alone. I knew intolerance better than most of my peers. But all of that helped me understand how to empathize with others. How to treat other people better.
Here you meet people from all over the world, and you can share your language, your religion, your beliefs in a respectful, open-minded environment. And that might not be the case in other places. That's what I hope for your generation and your children. And I know whatever we're going through at the moment, it will pass. And it will be love and acceptance always, hopefully.
I don't say I am Muslim but anymore. Now, I just say that I am Muslim, I am Persian, I am American, and I am proud. For Radioactive, I'm Soraya Marashi.
Soraya created that story in Radioactive's Intro to Journalism Workshop, and you can find them on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. After President Trump was sworn in, women in Seattle and across the country took to the streets. The marches were reportedly the biggest in U.S. history. And now some women are going beyond protest. They're running for office. David Hyde with KUOW's politics team has more.
When President Trump was elected, a lot of voters in the Seattle area were shocked. But Jamie Smith decided she had to act.
If Hillary had won, I probably wouldn't be running right now. It would have been one of those things where it's like, oh, I can push it off another 4 years. Now it's like, okay, somebody's got to clean up this crap, and I've got to prepare myself to do that. So now's the time. Let's get out there and let's go do it.
Smith's a manager at the Allen Institute here in Seattle. Last year, she was a national delegate for Hillary Clinton, and now she wants to serve on the Renton City Council.
I like to tell people that I went through the 5 stages of grief in like 30 minutes and then came back to anger and just kind of stayed there. When the Women's March was organized, it's like, yes, we get to say something, we get to do something.
But for Smith, doing something meant more than marching.
My passion is the problem, and you know what I want is the solution. And that's where I really felt like being in office gives me an opportunity to actually do something.
This weekend, Smith plans to attend a boot camp for women candidates here in Seattle. It's being put on by an organization called Emerge. They train Democratic women who are running for office or thinking about it. And Smith's excited because the advice she's already gotten from experienced women candidates has been invaluable. It's ranged from strategy to this fashion advice.
We have to be on point as far as our fashion and looking good all the time, and those shoes begin to hurt. And so you have a foot pad that you can switch out in your shoes to kind of lessen the pain of standing for long periods of time and things like that. Saved my life, changed my life. So
one of the speakers at the boot camp this weekend is Democrat Noelle Frame. She represents Seattle's 36th district in the state legislature.
People are absolutely clamoring to get involved in their democracy. I'm certainly really excited about that, and I'm seeing more women capture that opportunity and saying, you know, why not me, and why not now?
Frame says seeing more women run is more important this year than ever, even in a state that already has two women in the U.S. Senate and four in Congress.
Frankly, Washington used to be this national leader. In the 90s, we were at over 40% representation of women in the legislature, and that's steadily gone down.
But this year, that trend could change. In the 45th legislative district, for example, two women of color are competing to fill an open Senate seat. The result could determine which party controls the state Senate. But whoever wins, it could change the gender balance. Currently, only around 36% of lawmakers in the state legislature are women. Down in Renton, one of Smith's two opponents is incumbent city council member Ruth Perez. And Smith sees it as a sign of progress that there are two qualified women of color in that race.
Don't limit me or discriminate against me because of the color of my skin, but don't give me things that are unearned because of the color of my skin, too. Judge me by the content of my character and the viability of my ideas.
Here in Seattle, it's been around 90 years since a woman was mayor. But two-thirds of the candidates on stage at a recent mayor's forum were women, including lawyer and activist Nikita Oliver.
What do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
What do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
If we don't.
In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
If we don't get it.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. 15 years ago, Willie Parker had what sounds like an enviable life. He was an OBGYN, a faculty member at the University of Hawaii. He loved living in Honolulu. Willie was also a devout Christian, and if one of his patients wanted an abortion, he would refer them to another doctor. It wasn't that Willie opposed abortion, but he hadn't been trained in it. And throughout his career, he had worked in places where abortion wasn't really available anyway.
So it was more a lack of deep thought about whether or not there was actually a personal conflict between being Christian and providing abortions. And so I was able to operate in that milieu for the first 12 years of my practice.
Then the clinic in Hawaii where Dr. Parker worked got a new director who decided that clinic would stop offering abortion services altogether.
What was different this time and what brought me to what I call my come to Jesus moment and my moral crisis was that this time services were available. Hawaii was one of the first states to legalize abortion. And so in this particular clinic where indigent women were getting their care since 1970 up until 2001, over 30 years, they had access to abortion care, and now this administrator was cutting it off. So now I was a part of a system that was going to deny women access. And so now it was personal for me. And so I had to decide what was my reservation if I, to your point, didn't think abortion was morally wrong for a woman to make that decision. What was my inhibition around providing it?
You called it your inhibition. What was your inhibition?
Well, in the final analysis with the Good Samaritan story that Dr. King tells in his last sermon, there are two people who pass by an injured traveler. One's a priest and one's a Levite. One by vocation was obligated and one by community was obligated, and they both failed to help. And Dr. King speculated that their inability to help was potentially related to their concern about what would happen to them. And he said the Good Samaritan was good because he reversed the question of concern. And instead of asking, what will happen to me if I stop to help this person? He asked, what will happen to this person if I don't stop to help? And so what I came to conclude was that my inability to provide abortion wasn't that I thought it was immoral. It was my concern about how I would be perceived as a Christian, because I hadn't thought about whether or not it was truly mutually exclusive to be Christian and to provide abortion care. And I kind of came to the conclusion that it was a form of cowardice to not think about that more deeply and to conscientiously choose to provide or not to provide. And when I looked more deeply, I decided that compassion, which is an essential tenet of Christianity, does not modulate itself based on why the person has the need. It either responds to the need or it doesn't. And so it led me to conclude that I was not acting in accordance with my Christian values by refusing to provide the care that women need as a women's health provider.
You've said you grew up in the Southern Baptist Black Church and weren't sure whether Christianity and abortion were compatible. So I wonder, how do you maintain relationships with people who you love, whose Christian faith takes them to the opposite side of this abortion divide?
By rooting my Christian understanding in where I come from, and temporally, I came of age in the early 70s and 80s. By the time I was a teenager, when I had my Christian conversion experience in 1978, this all predated the whole moral majority's rise to power and the whole pro-life, pro-choice narrative. So by rooting my religious experience in that time period, it becomes clear that my whole thinking about abortion was never colored by the whole pro-life, pro-choice narrative, which my religious conversion and coming of age predates. And so as I went along, by the time that was in full effect and full swing in the mid-80s, I was a medical student. And so it was starting to, and then the violence and stuff was starting to swell and the clinic bombings and all of that. And so in my community, the people that I came of age with religiously, that narrative was never a point of tension with us. And so now in my 50s, when I returned home, people who knew me in my earlier Christian identity now recognize me as someone who's grown and evolved. And for those people who still approach the Bible as sacred text with a literal approach, it becomes clear to them that I don't approach the Bible or a Christian and spiritual understanding that way anymore. So we have honest disagreement. I came to realize that some of the people who I thought would be opposed to abortion, actually, they were supportive of abortion, and it didn't have anything to do with me, because I wasn't aware that they were already supportive of women because we had never had the conversation. So there really hasn't been a major loss of personal relationships for me. I left Birmingham when I was 18 years old. I'm now 54. And so the people who now know me, because I'm very public about the work that I do, they understand and they respect, or there have been some relationships that have naturally demised, and that's all okay.
All of it's okay.
All of that's okay.
I ask you because you talk about honest disagreement. It just seems so hard around abortion. It seems that the kind of thing that tears us apart or keeps us apart. And I wondered if you had any advice about understanding one another across, maybe the divide is not huge to you, but it is to so many of us.
Oh, the chasm is deep and wide, and that's not lost on me. But part of an effort to bridge that chasm was related to why I wrote the book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And that is, I decided that part of the tension is that the Mahatma Gandhi said that honest disagreement is the beginning of progress. And so if we're going to honestly disagree about the contentious issue of abortion, we have to be clear about how we're framing that conversation. And part of the tension is a false tension, I believe, related to scientific understandings of reproduction and religious or non-scientific understandings. And people unnecessarily pit those understandings against each other. Dr. King said that science gives mankind knowledge, which is power. Religion gives mankind wisdom, which is control. The two are not enemies. And I took that to mean, besides it being the wisdom by which I operate my life, As someone who's trained in obstetrics and gynecology, who my chosen craft is human reproduction, and as someone who's also a Christian, I'm trained as a scientist and I practice as a Christian, I'm clear that there's a religious understanding of reproduction and a scientific one, and they don't compete with each other. It only becomes problematic when we try and answer religious questions with scientific answers or scientific questions with religious answers. And so I, in effort to have a conversation that's focused on the morality of abortion, which encompasses we all are moral agents, we all make decisions, we all have a sense of what is right and wrong, but morals govern your personal behavior. The question is, should we be legislating something that is governed by conscience? My answer is no. And so if conscience is the domain of the religious and that's personal, then that means that the religious governance of reproduction should be with a person's conscience. But how we govern the practice of reproduction societally based on policies and rules and laws, that's not the same conversation. Science should govern those conversations.
Obviously, not everyone listening right now agrees with you, but Seattle is a very pro-choice town, and it sounds like maybe you would like them to think differently about this abortion chasm, as you said. It's deep and wide, but it's not unbridgeable?
It's not unbridgeable. I find the whole pro-life, pro-choice narrative problematic. It's categorical. It lends itself great to theater, but it doesn't lead to critical thinking. You know, pro-choice, pro-life means people can just kind of declare where they stand without thinking. The narrative is not pro-life, pro-choice. I'm pro-choice and pro-life. I'm in support of the life of the woman. I'm in support of a woman making choices about her life. Pro-life is not the same as being anti-abortion. So I think the real tension is that we don't have the right framing of the issue. The issue is anti-abortion and pro-abortion. And when I say pro-abortion, I'm pro-abortion in the same way a cardiothoracic surgeon is pro-heart transplant. They don't want people to have heart disease and to need a heart transplant, but they want to make sure that anybody who needs a heart transplant from cardiac disease can get one. So abortion is not bad, it's not good, it's necessary, and it is healthcare. Pro-life or anti-abortion is you don't want to have an abortion and you're free not to have one, but anti-abortion means you don't want anybody else to have an abortion. So that's a different from a pro-life, pro-choice. Pro-choice means the person who can have an abortion needs to be able to have one, but it's not the empowerment to force people to have abortions. So what should be the default? It has to be that people who want to have abortions and need to have them should be able to have them. People who don't want to have them should be free not to have them. But no one should be able to encroach upon the other person if they don't agree.
I've been talking with Dr. Willie Parker, and the book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Welcome to Seattle, and thanks for talking with us, Doctor.
Thanks for having me.
KUOW's new podcast, How's Your Day?, tells you a story that you don't know from a day we all remember. These are the personal stories that happen in the shadow of historic events. And today we look at February 1st, 2003.
My fellow Americans, this day has brought terrible news and great sadness to our country. At 9 o'clock this morning, Mission Control in Houston lost contact with our space shuttle Columbia. A short time later, debris was seen falling from the skies above Texas. The Columbia is lost. There are no survivors.
My thoughts are still on what happened this morning. My thoughts are on seven families, children, spouses, extended family. My thoughts are on their grief. My thoughts are on what we missed, what I missed to allow this to happen.
It's going to be a difficult day for all of us.
I was 29, like just a few months away from turning 30. I worked as a radio host at a radio station up in Seattle.
94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Megan Sukies.
It was early morning, like 6 in the morning, and the phone rang. Daddy had an accident. Oh my God, it's here, it's the moment, this is really happening. So I hung up the phone with my sister and I called my boss to tell him that I wasn't going to be there. I say, hey, are you busy? He said, yeah, I'm a little busy, Megan. I don't know if you've heard, but the space shuttle Columbia just exploded. No, I didn't hear. I just heard that my dad is dying and I need to go home, to fly home and see my dad, what was left of him. And so we go into the hospital, and this hospital in Fayetteville is a real old one. Fayetteville's a smaller town. And on the lower floors, you can feel how old it is. Everything's yellowed and dusty and creaky and smells like decades of hospital. And I can see my dad through the glass. And they've got the TVs on in his room.
NASA's Johnson Space Center, let's listen to a more technical briefing.
And then we'll throw it open for questions. So with that, I'll...
And the TVs are on CNN, and you can see all the news going on, still the coverage about the space shuttle explosion.
Those long radio blackouts. And at this juncture...
And then there's my dad not watching it, because he's, for all intents and purposes, he's dead. And I felt like I couldn't breathe. It felt like there was no oxygen in the room. And I wanted nothing more than to tell stories about him, to talk with him, to be able to say, how sad is this? Can you believe this is really going on? Are we all heartbroken? But nothing. You couldn't say anything. That was kind of the rule of the family, is we're not going to say anything.
That was an excerpt from our new podcast, How's Your Day? To hear the rest of Megan's story or to subscribe to the podcast, go to kuow.org/podcast. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You may have heard live this morning on KUOW that the FBI director, whom President Trump fired, testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee. In case you missed it, James Comey said he felt he needed to document his interactions with the then president-elect Donald Trump because of the circumstances, the subject matter, and the person he was dealing with.
I was alone with the president of the United States, or the president-elect, soon to be president. The subject matter, I was talking about matters that touch on the FBI's core responsibility and that relate to the president, president-elect personally, and then the nature of the person. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document. That combination of things I'd never experienced before, but it led me to believe I got to write it down, and I got to write it down in a very detailed way.
Regarding the former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, Comey said President Trump told him, quote, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy." Comey did not say that this was Trump obstructing justice.
I don't think it's for me to say whether the conversation I had with the president was an effort to obstruct. I took it as a very disturbing thing, very concerning, but that's a conclusion I'm sure the special counsel will work towards to try and understand what the intention was there and whether that's an offense.
So it's up to the special counsel to establish what the president intended. But Comey does have an opinion of why Trump allegedly told him. Again, quote, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting Flynn go." Here's Comey telling Idaho Republican Senator Jim Risch what he thought Trump meant.
I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the president of the United States with me alone saying, "I hope this." I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
You may have taken it as a direction, but that's not what he said.
Correct.
He said, "I hope."
Those are exact words. Okay. Correct.
You don't know of anyone that's ever been charged for hoping something. Is that a fair statement?
I don't, as I sit here.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Top Republicans came out and said Trump was not obstructing justice. He just didn't know how to handle the Department of Justice. Here is House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Of course, there needs to be a degree of independence between DOJ, FBI, and a White House, and a line of communications established. The president's new at this. He's new to government. And so he probably wasn't steeped in the long-running protocols that establish the relationships between DOJ, FBI, and White Houses. He's just new to this.
So that is some of what the former FBI Director James Comey said today before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. That you heard on KUOW this morning. And then there's the reaction to the whole affair. Twitter did what it does best, and we captured some of that, too, at KUOW's website. Just go to our homepage, KUOW.org, and scan some of the top tweets. Finally, President Trump's personal attorney reacted after the whole event by saying the president never in form or substance directed James Comey to stop investigating anyone. That includes Michael Flynn. That was Mark Kasowitz responding to Comey's Thursday morning testimony, in which the FBI director said Trump urged him to drop the Flynn case before firing James Comey. We'll continue our coverage of that, of course, here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I thank you for listening today. Come back tomorrow for KUOW's Week in Review with guest host C.R. Douglas. He'll take on the week's big stories with Joni Balter, Jonathan Martin, and Essex Porter. And you must tune in on Monday. My guests will be Steve Ballmer and Sherman Alexie, live on our Monday edition of KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now stay tuned for the BBC up ahead on KUOW.